Hello and welcome to the PharmaForum podcast. I'm your host, Jonah Comstock. Among the many struggles faced by the digital therapeutics industry is the difficulty of designing and running effective clinical trials. As a still young category, they often face uncharted regulatory waters, and the extensive data collection that's possible with digital therapeutics can become a double-edged sword when it adds cost and complexity to trials. My guest today is Mary Beckwith, co-founder of Lindus Health, a next-gen CRO that includes digital therapeutics among its specialties. Mary is here to talk a little bit about often unseen difficulties of validating a digital therapeutic through a clinical trial. Welcome to the show, Mary.
Cool. Thanks so much for having me, Jonah. Yeah, really excited to discuss this.
So first of all, a little about yourself and about Lindus. You guys brand yourselves as an anti-CRO. What does that mean?
Yeah, slightly tongue-in-cheek. So, we're playing on the fact there that, traditional CROs, frankly, just don't have the best kind of reputation. But what we mean by anti-CRO is that, like a CRO, we're capable of executing entire clinical trials end-to-end, so that full kind of service. But the anti part is we do so with a very different business model. So a business model that's entirely aligned with the incentives of our customers. We only ever kind of bill our customers when we reach pre-agreed milestones. That's in contrast to like the CRO model, where it's billing, based on an hourly rate, where frankly they make more money the worse and the more delayed a clinical trial goes. And the other kind of point of difference is that we have our own technology platform, which works hand in glove with our clinical operations team, which makes, the whole clinical trial a lot smoother.
How long have you guys been in the digital therapeutics trials business?
For about 3 years. So as long as we've been running clinical trials, really, yeah.
Well, let's just jump right into it. What are some of the unique challenges there that these companies run into?
Yeah, so a really good question. I mean, in short, the biggest kind of overall issue is that you apply like the kind of clinical, you basically apply like a pharma drug standard to what is effectively a kind of safe, kind of low risk intervention, like a digital therapeutic. That can result in, much higher costs, kind of massive overruns and delays, and just ultimately, you're not getting the evidence you need. I think that point's doubly important because what we've seen happen in the digital therapeutic space is that even though these are fundamentally, low risk or really safe products in most respects, payers and providers are just generally skeptical of anything digital, frankly. And so they demand a higher bar of evidence for efficacy than you'd see from, traditional drugs. So basically, if I were a digital therapeutic company, I'd think about just maximizing the amount of evidence I can get per dollar spent. And, you need to do that. You need to think really carefully about how you design and run your clinical trials as a result.
Yeah. I mean, digital therapeutics in general are kind of a weird animal, right? Because they're often run like tech companies, but they do need to sort of gather evidence and set themselves up to gather evidence similarly to the way that a pharma or a biotech company would. And I do, when I go to these events and I hear digital therapeutics people talk about like do's and don'ts, that's often a theme, is sort of like, how much evidence should I be gathering? Should I be gathering evidence for regulators or for payers, or what kind of evidence, what KPIs? There's a lot of, it feels like, sort of uncertainty in this, and the idea that you have to know the answers to these questions early on, or else you might kind of get burned later on down the road, right?
Yeah, it's also because digital therapeutics is such a new category, and so there's just not established like standards or like agreed standards about what good evidence looks like effectively. And I think that's the uncertainty everyone deals with. There is progress being made, but of course it's not as fast as we'd like. Yeah.
So that's one issue here is that there's this mismatch, right? It's a low risk product, but people are investing in a high level of evidence standard that maybe is more than they need. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, you could say that like by definition, the evidence standard they need is whatever like payers and providers are demanding. But like just from a theoretical standpoint, as a low risk or like zero risk intervention, logically, you just should need or you shouldn't need the same level of evidence as you do for theoretically a high risk drug product.
But part of this issue is that it comes down to kind of perception, right? There was do digital therapeutics, if they want to be seen as therapeutics, right, then do they need to be evaluated in the way that therapeutics are, so that then a payer will pay a bunch more for them than they would for an app, right? I mean, it's really thorny.
Yeah, I, you know, definitely. So, so like, you know, they need to generate enough evidence to kind of to support like, you know, like an ROI or sort of a an economic case. I think what we kind of see just like a sweeping generalization is that, you know, even kind of well-conducted studies are kind of are sometimes or, you know, more is sometimes demanded of them than all else being equal, a kind of drug study from a payer or provider. Yeah.
Are there other issues we haven't talked about yet beyond this kind of this overspec issue?
Yeah, I mean, you know, once you sort of get a level deeper, yeah, I mean, there's tons of like specific things that, you know, something we hear a lot is, you know, maybe a digital therapeutics company is partnered with a larger pharma company and the pharma company, you know, gets one of their standard CROs to run the trial and it's a complete disaster. You know, because the CRO is thinking about this from a drug paradigm. And so they're putting, you know, tons of processes and tons of stuff around like pharmacovigilance and sort of safety monitoring, even though that's just not required. If you look at like the FDA's guidance on, you know, what good looks like for a medical device clinical trial, this then makes, you know, patient recruitment slower. It has kind of huge knock-on effects on sort of the overall conduct of the trial. When really, you know, I think like coming back to that point about like what is the most valuable evidence per dollar spent on research for digital therapeutics companies, it's probably, you know, it's focusing less on safety, probably more on like health economic outcomes. And even when, you know, we're helping companies run pivotal clinical trials for like an FDA 510K or de novo approval, we always have in the back of our minds, like, are there small tweaks we could make to generate valuable health economic data that would, you know, so that the trial for like the same cost not just gets them their regulatory approval, but also gets them, you know, noticed and potentially reimbursed by payers. So I think it's just, you know, you just need to just have different priorities in mind when running these studies. So just to kind of fully bottom out that point. But that, you know, there are also some other kind of nuances of how these studies run too, where like, you know, they need to really be tailored for the type of product you're running them with. I mean, one thing is, you know, this idea of decentralized trials. So, you know, ideally, your kind of clinical trial should closely mimic how the product, the device should be used in like the actual real world. For a lot of digital therapeutics, you know, patients are going to use this product in their home, kind of in their own time. And so something like a decentralized clinical trial, which is a clinical trial where the trial largely takes place or completely takes place, you know, remotely in the patient's home, is a good fit because that does actually match how the patients will use the product, you know, when it's prescribed to them. And so considering, you know, it's not right for every clinical trial, but considering that kind of design can be useful. They also tend to be cheaper and faster to run too. So yeah, those are, you know, just some other thoughts there and happy to share kind of more learnings around, yeah, design specifically for DTX trials.
Yeah, well, let's throw one more in there and that'll kind of segue you into the design question, which is shams and placebos. I've heard that's a really tricky thing with digital therapeutics because what exactly is your comparator? I mean, is it Candy Crush or is it no app at all or where do you
land? Yeah, you're right. This is, you know, the FDA in particular is, you know, it tends to ask for a sham app as a comparator. They're actually, you know, they're getting a little bit less stringent on this point. But, you know, what can happen is, frankly, your sham app is too good, right? Because if you think about your control arm, you want it to kind of mimic placebo. The FDA, I think, is essentially kind of misapplying a kind of traditional medical device paradigm here, where the FDA will often ask for your sham app to be like the shell of an app, but without like the, you know, the mechanism of action, which for a digital therapeutic app, this is something like, you know, CBT or something. Now, if you have a patient who's got even just like a shell of an app, it's probably reminding them about their condition. It's probably like having, you know, some effect beyond just like a pure placebo effect, right? And so you can often see, you know, where three-arm studies have been run, for instance, with like no, you know, no treatment whatsoever, a sham app and the real app. You can often see the sham app having, you know, a lot more of effect than the sort of nil arm. So with all that said, it can be really important to get the design. If the FDA is asking for a sham app, it's really important to get, you know, that design right. Make sure it you know, it doesn't, frankly, it's not, you know, overstepping in terms of efficacy. But it's funny, like outside of the FDA, a lot of digital therapeutics companies are looking at things like DIGA in Germany, which is a whole separate topic we can get into if we want. But, you know, they're often happy for things like waitlist controls, so where they're comparing against a population of patients, you know, with no treatment whatsoever, because in reality, that's often, you know, what's happening, right? Because there are often long waiting lists for treatment. And so the most relevant comparator is like nothing at all. But anyway, huge topic. We could probably talk for hours on this, but yeah.
But it's really interesting. I mean, the placebo effect, that the whole sort of point of having something like that, it's reasonable to assume it doesn't work the same way with an app as it does with a sugar pill. I mean, it's a weird leap to kind of try to apply and assume that
exactly. Because like, you know, the FDA, I mean, I think, you know, they're building off the precedent of like, if you have like a traditional medical device, like a deep brain stimulation device or something, you know, the comparator with it, where it's like an invasive, like physical product that, you know, interacts with your body. The comparator they look for there is like the device without, you know, the deep brain stimulation, which makes a little bit more sense in like a physical device paradigm. But as you say, is it gets a lot trickier when the device isn't physical. So, yeah.
So when you work with a client on digital therapeutics, what are some, I mean, I don't want to retread any ground here, but like, when they come to you, do they have these problems and they're looking for solutions, or do they not even necessarily know what problems they have, or, you know, they've got an idea about something and you have to kind of say, hey, that's not as good an idea as you think it is, or you're missing this, or what's the kind of state of awareness in the field around some of these issues?
Yeah, it's pretty varied. I would say on the kind of, say more trial naive end, you know, companies are coming to us with, you know, we've got the overall objective of, let's say, running a trial for, you know, an FDA kind of pivotal trial for our product. And then some of these, you know, second order questions around like comparator, you know, specific study design, they have yet to work out, and we can definitely help them with that. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you know, we've got clients who have kind of everything figured out down to their protocol. Maybe they've had feedback from the FDA in like a pre-sub process, and they're just ready to go, and they just need someone to kind of execute the study end to end extremely quickly and, you know, to an FDA standard, which is definitely what we can do. We're honestly happy with, you know, with both ends of the spectrum and everyone in between. Yeah.
And how do you keep costs down? Because part of the issue here, right, is that the other side of the scale here, in terms of like pharma trials, very expensive to run, but you can count on making a bunch of money from the drug. So that bounces out. Digital therapeutics, the business models are less tested. They're often on a different scale than that. So there's a lot of incentive to run the trial more cheaply so that you don't have to, you know, make blockbuster drug money in order to justify it. What are some of the steps you can take there to kind of maintain the data integrity, make sure people are, you know, have good, robust data that they need, but keep them from breaking the bank?
Yeah, definitely. It's a really good point. So one kind of meta thing we do, which is our business model. So, you know, I mentioned that CROs typically bill by the hour, and so they have every incentive to find ways to add more cost and complexity because that's how they make money. You know, we just bill for the outcome, which is the entire clinical trial. So for our customers, you know, it's one fixed cost for the entire clinical trial. And then it's kind of incumbent on us to find ways to deliver that as efficiently as possible. So, you know, our incentives are aligned there. But, you know, how we can actually do that is, so I mentioned sort of, you know, considering a decentralized design that often helps reduce cost, where patients are, you know, seen remotely via kind of a nurse doctor. And, you know, they provide, we capture the data you need for the study remotely. It's often a good fit for DTX products. The second way is just paying very close attention to FDA guidelines on, you know, best practice for running, yeah, is the way the FDA sees it, you know, low-risk medical device trials, which is what these are. So that's things like ensuring that, you know, monitoring is still done to an FDA standard, but you don't need to go the full overboard, you know, 100% source data verification, multiple in-person monitoring visits that you typically see from like a pharma trial. Another way is just thinking really creatively about patient recruitment. Again, you know, anything we can do to kind of speed up the study, help hit full patient recruitment faster is better. And so, you know, we can do things like, we've got a network of, you know, 30 million patients. We can pre-screen and enroll them directly into studies, you know, activate that to kind of hit full enrollment really quickly. That helps keep costs down. And then, yeah, I mean, I think the final thing is, you know, where we do need to work with physical sites, just ensuring that, you know, we can automate as much of the burden on the site, on the patient as possible. So things like, you know, automatic reminders for visits, helping capture data, you know, automatically, not asking people to kind of fill in multiple forms, starting to get into a lot of detail, but, you know, just things where, like, essentially software can pick up the burden rather than expensive, you know, clinical trial project managers or clinicians.
I'm actually glad you mentioned patient burden, because we haven't really talked about that one yet, and that's a big deal too. I mentioned in the intro about kind of data overload. I mean, these products inherently are creating, they're capturing a lot of data, and that's one of the strengths of digital therapeutics. But does that cause problems in terms of making it too complex for the patient and creating sort of engagement and retention problems? Does it add unnecessary complexity on the back end of the trial with, you know, processing that data and analyzing it? What are some pitfalls there?
I mean, you know, honestly, like, it's, at least for us, you know, we find it extremely simple if all of the data, you know, is being captured directly from the patient. So you know, that this, because, like, if it's all captured on our platform, you know, we mandate that it gets captured in the FDA's kind of preferred data format. So it's all captured in the same format, all stored sort of in one place. So it's actually like the platonic ideal of a clinical trial from our perspective. And again, you know, that helps keep the cost down as well. From the patient burden out, super important. So, you know, when we sort of survey patients and talk to patients, I mean, they really don't mind, you know, filling out questionnaires as long as they kind of understand, you know, when the questionnaires need to be filled out, how frequently. There's kind of good signposting of information. I think that part's really important, so they don't get fatigue. Generally, patients are, you know, much prefer being able to kind of fill out questionnaires from home or just, you know, on their own pace, versus like the more traditional clinical trial model, which is, you know, coming in for lots of kind of potentially invasive medical tests. So although it, you know, it can be a patient burden, I think generally, you know, where the endpoints are more questionnaire based, generally lower burden, higher patient satisfaction and higher retention, versus like asking a patient maybe to take time off work to, you know, come in for loads of in-person visits. Yeah.
Of course, the flip side there is right. Like, do they do it? Right. Do they fill in the thing? Do they answer the quest? I mean, what tools can you use to make sure that engagement is at that level?
Yeah, it's a really good point. So here we try and get clever with how we use our software. So we have things that, like, you know, we look, if a patient has like answered a bunch of questions really quickly, that suggests that they're not really like answering the questions. They're just kind of clicking through, and that kind of creates an alert. And, you know, one of our nurses will call the patient, for instance, and check in with them and say, hey, did you really fill this out? We can also do like customized schedules. So like when, let's say, you know, in a study, a patient has to, you know, fill out this questionnaire every month, you know, we'll generally, like, on as part of onboarding, talk to all of our patients and say, like, hey, you know, when's the right, you know, when's an easy time for you to fill out these questionnaires? They're going to come every month. Patients will often say, like, well, you know, I work late shifts, whatever. So, you know, mornings are better for me. We can say, like, okay, make sure that these patients always get sent, you know, questionnaires in the morning, so it fits around their schedule. So I think, you know, just paying really close attention to how patients kind of live their normal lives and ensuring the clinical trial fits around that as far as possible, and then automating, you know, stuff in the background that makes the patient and the clinical trial staff's life easier. Yeah.
We talked a little bit about regulators, both in the United States and in Europe, where maybe the regulation is a little further along in some ways, but that's exactly what I wanted to touch base on. So right now, regulatory confusion and sort of lack of standards is a problem. But I know that's changing, and it does feel like the regulatory bodies are very aware of this category and would like to kind of lock in the rules and the guidelines a little more. So from your standpoint, how is that going? Are we close to a point where this is going to, regulatory confusion and regulatory complexity is going to become less of an issue?
Okay, so I have kind of a hot take here, which is that I think the regulators on the whole have done a pretty good job at standardizing, you know, what bar these products need to hit in terms of kind of safety to become approved products and efficacy to become approved products. So like, you know, the FDA de novo 510K pathway, you know, in Europe, the CE mark, I think, you know, that's at a pretty good place. What is not in a good place is more on the kind of payer acceptance side, like what good efficacy looks like from a payer perspective. So, you know, what kinds of outcomes they want to see over what time frame, are those, you know, what health economic outcomes, what sort of, you know, medical clinical outcomes. That is still a bit of a challenge, frankly, and kind of all over the place. And I think where, you know, some companies have have found it difficult, where, you know, the goalposts seem to be shifting. Unfortunately, it's more of a coordination problem because, you know, some works like the Digital Medicine Society, the Digital Therapeutics Alliance are doing awesome work to kind of, you know, bring those parties together and try and get agreement on what good looks like. But it's not like there are, you know, just a handful of regulators who can just say, like, unilaterally, like, yep, this is what you need to do.
Payers are a much larger group.
Exactly.
So alignment is a trickier goal. And it seems like the market should do its thing, right? And tell people what it needs. But there's not even really alignment on what the right business model is for digital therapeutics. There's people going direct to consumer. There's people going to employers. There's people seeking payer reimbursement. There's people who think that the provider should be the customer. And so it really does feel like even as far into it as we are, when it comes to the business model, there's a little bit of this kind of Wild West, we're still figuring out what works kind of mentality.
Yeah, I think definitely agree with that. And you know, I think that's fine, right? Like, that is, you know, as a kind of young company, one of your biggest strengths is being able to, you know, pivot quickly, try, you know, fail fast, whatever, all of the hackneyed phrases. But, like, you know, we've seen the digital therapeutics companies that are finding a lot of success now, like, you know, Sidekick is one that comes to mind. They've been really good at kind of exploring, you know, all of these options and trying to make the most of them. Whereas the companies, I think, that have staked everything on, you know, just one avenue have struggled a bit more. But yeah.
I mean, to take us full circle, I think what is one thing that's currently going out of vogue that used to be very in vogue was partnering with a pharma company as a digital therapeutic. And I imagine that when we're talking about what kind of data we need, how robust our clinical trials need to be, there is some thought of, like, if we want to work with a pharma company, then we need to have pharma company quality data. I mean, is that a piece of the puzzle, or?
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't, you know, I don't, I'm not sure there is such a thing as, like, pharma company quality data. I guess, you know,
I guess, sort of the data quality they're accustomed to in the world of drugs is sort of what I was getting at. But maybe I'm off the mark.
I see what you mean. I guess, like, you know, yeah. So I guess where I'm coming from, like, the pharma way of running a clinical trial, I think, like, if anything, generates worse quality data. Like this, you know, for just as one instance, like, you know, a pharma company will typically, you know, only recruit patients via physical sites. And so you'll end up with most clinical trials with, like, you know, 200 sites to recruit 600 patients. Each one is a source of error, wildly different standards at each one. Like, that is just manifest, like, the data quality from that study, all else being equal, will be manifestly worse than one run at, like, three sites, or even one that was potentially decentralized. Huge generalization, because, of course, like, under the hood. So, like, I guess, but I agree insofar as, like, you know, pharma company budgets, they can afford really big clinical trials, which more data, right? So, you know, which ultimately is kind of higher quality evidence. So I guess, yeah, sorry, just to kind of go deep on that point, because, you know, what we've seen, at least in the digital therapeutics realm, when pharma takes their usual model of, like, running clinical trials, it you know, doesn't necessarily result in higher quality data. But budgets, certainly, they've got a lot more money to throw at it. Yeah.
Interesting distinction. I want to turn it over to you now. Is there anything we haven't talked about yet that you think is an interesting piece of the puzzle or an important perspective here?
Yeah. Just kind of like one overall comment, you know, just talk to a lot of the companies. Actually, I can think of a couple of things, but, you know, think about a lot of the digital therapeutics companies we work with. You know, there are some really interesting things happening on the kind of payer access front. So a lot of people listening to this podcast may have heard of DiGA, which is the German system. It's effectively a unified reimbursement system where you can, for digital health products, where you can submit evidence of efficacy of your product and then sort of, like, bid on a pricing per prescription, basically. And then, you know, your product can just be prescribed by German insurers. So in other words, it's like a very kind of straightforward, sort of transparent route to market for these products. That's super interesting. France have just launched Paycon, which is effectively the same system. And I think Belgium, a couple of the countries in Europe, one of the Baltics are sort of following suit. So I think there's a lot of sort of interesting things happening, particularly in Europe, around this route to market, which, you know, should be really interesting for digital therapeutics companies, no matter where they're located. So, yeah, just a shout out there. But yeah, I mean, apart from that, yeah, I think really good discussion. So yeah.
It does seem like Diga is attracting some imitators. There's a sense that, you know, if Germany has found something that's working, then, you know, other countries might try to follow suit.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the programs, you know, from what I can tell, is a pretty big success, or it's seen as like a big success in like policy wonk circles, put it that way. Or sorry, that's a UK, you know, kind of policy nerd circles, like tech health policy nerds. So, you know, a lot of, I think a lot of countries are looking to imitate it. I mean, something like that for the US would be, I'm not quite sure how it would work because the payer landscape is a bit more fragmented, but that would be a huge win.
Thank you so much for chatting with me today, Mary. This is a super interesting topic. I think sometimes we neglect digital therapeutics until like it's DTX time and then we talk about it. So it's good to check in now about what's going on in the space. And I think that the, you know, clinical trials and digital therapeutics are both areas I'm very interested in. And so to kind of take a deep dive into the intersection between the two is really interesting. And I hope it may be folks who didn't know about Lindus before who might have a need to get into that space. And by the way, besides digital therapeutics, what are your other kind of specialty areas as a CRO?
Yeah, no, thanks. So, I mean, you know, ultimately we specialize in running radically faster, higher quality clinical trials for really all types of life science companies. You know, we do have good experience within kind of digital health, digital therapeutics, but, you know, we've also run studies for everyone from smaller biotechs up to, you know, top 10 pharma companies. And you know, we particularly specialize in a few therapeutic areas like metabolic, neurology, CNS, reproductive health, respiratory, to name a couple. But, you know, we're always happy to chat, you know, help companies, your listeners, think through some of these challenges, even if they're not, you know, strictly clinical trial related. So, yeah, I'm happy for anyone to reach out and have a conversation.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Mary. Really, really appreciate your input here and have a great rest of your day.
Thanks. You too, Jonah. Great to chat.
That concludes this episode of the Pharma Forum podcast. You can find more information about this episode, including a download link and information about other installments in the series at pharmaforum.com/podcast. The Pharma Forum podcast is also available on iTunes, Spotify, Acast, Stitcher, and Podme, where you can find and subscribe by searching for Pharma Forum. And don't forget to visit our website, where you can sign up for daily news and analysis bulletins, and to follow us on Twitter at @PharmaForum. Thanks for listening.